Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, an ongoing endeavor by able and willing students to grasp the Urantia book in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 138, section 8. It's our arc, Jesus Goes Public. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or set foot on the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water, yielding its fruit in season, whose leaf does not wither, and who prospers in all he does. I'm Brad Garner. I'm so glad that you're here with us live or in our archive. Symmetryofsoul.org is the archive. With me tonight is Dr. Chris Halverson, our teacher, Andrea Barnes, Kermit Anderson, and there's you. Please open up the text of the Urantia papers however you see fit and settle in for about 1% of your week with us as we explore the lands of Galilee and all the things that everyone was up to over there. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Well, good evening, Brad. It's great to have you back again. Glad you're starting to feel better. And hello to you, Andrea, and Kermit, and everyone who's joining us live here. As Brad said, unless you're in the archive, which I know many of you do on a regular basis, thank you for all of our archive listeners. And we are going to be wrapping up this series. We've done many broadcasts here now on this series, trying to get through the precursor and the prelude. But you know, we should remember that's telling us something, you know, in itself, that Jesus didn't just fly off, you know, on a whim before he began his public ministry. There was a very lengthy, complex prelude to his public ministry, and we've been carefully stepping our way through it. So it's not unlike, you know, the length of the preface to the final paper that the faith of Jesus developed over a long, gradual process, and that very lengthy preface speaks to that.
It does, and I enjoy how a few weeks ago when we were at the end of paper 137, I thought that our series had ended. I thought precursor and prelude were over. I guess I was being a little impatient. Come on, get to the preaching stuff. But why would I want to do that? I miss all this tremendous material that we have here. And six more apostles getting recruited. You can't leave them out. So
yeah, I mean, James and John were being left out, you know, by Jesus. And, you know, you were leaving out half of them.
Half of them. You know. The democratically elected half. That's right. Exactly. All right. Well, good evening to you, Andrea. How's everything out your way?
Everything's just going great out here, Brad. I was wondering was that a Bible passage, and what part of the Bible were you reading from there?
Oh, that's the famed Psalm 1, the one that starts them all off, the Amenemope one that is revealed to us was even more ancient wisdom than other things in Psalms.
Yeah, I was curious a couple weeks ago when Chris mentioned that, and I actually opened my Bible up and read it, and so I thought that's what it was. And then I thought about what he said about Amenemope, and I'd be curious about that, but we want to get Kermit up here and say hello.
Before we go to Kermit, Andrea, your audio is muddled. Can you adjust your mic or something?
How about now?
There we go.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, I had a fan on me. I think it was kind of the fan that was messing things up.
Well, we'll do the best that we can tonight. Sometimes issues.
Try to keep close to the mic.
Yeah.
Okay, I will.
Onward we will go, the best that we can.
Okay.
Technology being what it is. And Kermit, good evening to you. Great to hear your voice. I'm glad to be back this week, and I'm looking forward to hearing your summary of where we were last week.
Well, good evening, Brad. I'm glad to be here in my regular place. Good to have you back. And I'm just wondering if you're noticing on the switchboard, we've got a hand raised for a possible caller. wonder if we should take that call before I read the summary. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I suppose we can. Let's see what's on someone's mind out there.
Okay.
All right, I'm here.
There you go. Area code 951, you're on Symmetry of Soul.
Hi, this is Vaughn Tosmo.
Oh, hi, Vaughn.
Hi, Vaughn.
Good evening.
I pocket dialed you.
Do you also pocket dial raise your hand?
Well, I think it's on this particular cell phone. It's a pushing the button number one.
Yeah.
But I noticed I had, in my pocket I had some other stuff. I got a bunch of litter in my pocket, and pushed up two or three other buttons prior to the number one.
Well, we're glad to hear from you all the same. So,
we can thank Supremacy, you know, or Providence here for letting us say hi.
Well, I have two phone numbers. Only cost me $10 extra to be able to find my first phone when I set the second phone down. When I heard you say that we had a caller, I was busy thinking, and it just was very easy for me to pop in for me to be glad to be able to tell you how much I enjoy your show. I listen to it. I listen to several things on my cell phone every week, and I love this. And thank you very much for everything.
Well, you're most welcome. Thank you.
I'll let you go.
All right.
Thanks,
okay,
Vaughn. Take care.
Thanks, Vaughn.
All right. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, I put him back on a listen-only mode, and I'll get on with the summary. Further discussion on righteousness led to a brief consideration of one of Dr. Chris's writings, Divine Ideals, The Ways of Righteous Living, wherein distinction is made between the existential divine ideal of love in the inner life and four experiential divine ideals, preeminence of the individual, family life, national life, and representative government. The experiential divine ideals were further associated with four domains of human activity: religion, society, politics, and science, respectively. Listen to the archive for further details. Symmetry of Soul frequently points out that persons cannot cause growth, but they can supply favorable conditions for being grown. But growth in what sense? Think growth in conformity with the cosmos, that is, righteousness. The experiential divine ideals are built and anchored on the ideal of the existential and absolute divine love of the Father. Further exploration of divine love led us to paper 56, section 10, paragraph 21. Love is the desire to do good to others. At first glance, this simple statement can be taken for a platitude. After deeper reflection, we find that this desire is a purely inner life phenomenon. Loving service to our fellows requires translation of this inner desire to the cosmic totality attitude of God the Mother. Attempts to manifest the absolute, exclusively focused love of the Father directly in service to our fellows becomes self-righteousness. The manifold circumstances of the external life condition the precise nature and form service must take in order for it to be cosmically harmonious and genuinely righteous. We can hardly hope to claim to be second miler kingdom builders until this desire to do good to others attains the level of universal inclusiveness of all mankind in our consecrations. We began our reading, The Call of the Twins, in paper 138, section 4, The Call of the Twins, Jesus and the apostles, now eight in number, journeyed across the Sea of Galilee to formally call the Alpheus twins to receive to service as apostles. Jesus called them with the same two-word invitation, follow me. It is suggested from the narrative that during the personal ministry of the first six chosen apostles, two and two, about the Sea of Galilee, the new nominees for apostolic service were contacted by their sponsors and were expecting the formal invitation to join the apostles. Jesus, in the wake of the lighthearted dinner arranged by Matthew, specifically instructed the apostles, now numbering 10, that the Father does not despise any creature of his making. The apostles are enjoined to break bread with any and all who desire to hear of the kingdom. The kingdom is open to all who desire to know the truth and to find God. As the twins were received into the apostolic family, Jesus gave his first lesson on the origin, nature, and destiny of unclean spirits. Not for the last time are we told that the apostles had considerable difficulty understanding what Jesus told them, but they found it very easy to love and admire him. Section 5, the call of Thomas and Judas. The 11 now proceeded to call on Thomas and Judas Iscariot. Here we find Jesus adds a preface to his simple follow me invitation. To Thomas, Jesus says, Thomas, you lack faith. Nevertheless, I receive you. Follow me. To Judas, he adds a more ominous comment to the effect that he prayed Judas would stay loyal to his Galilean brethren. Jesus' teaching on the nature and work of the Holy Spirit was again only partially comprehended by the 12. The apostles persisted in making the mistake of trying to fit Jesus' new gospel. In actuality, Macaventa's gospel of trust in God and salvation through faith into their old forms of religious belief. Recall, Macaventa's gospel had given way to the works righteousness way of securing God's favor held by the Hebrews. Section 6, the week of intensive training. In true evolutional fashion, Jesus instructed the first six apostles to review with the new ones all they had learned and experienced in preparation for the work of the kingdom. At this time, Jesus instituted the practice of setting aside each Wednesday for rest and recreation. Interestingly, many Christian congregations set aside Wednesdays for church community activities. The Master attempted to clarify the difference between his teachings and his life among them from the teachings likely to spring up about him. He earnestly endeavored to foster their comprehension of his religion, his faith, and discouraged their preaching and teaching a religion about him and about his teaching. But alas, it is sad to record, this distinction and practice is not at all clear, even among the devotees of the fifth epical revelation. Even though Jesus' endowments were stupendous and he had unlimited power at his disposal to further his mission, he was content to employ 12 ordinary men as his ambassadors. Section 7, another disappointment. Jesus had planned for a 5-month campaign of personal work. The apostles came to him anticipating the proclamation of the kingdom in Capernaum or Jerusalem and inquiring as to their positions in proclaiming the kingdom. They were chastened, stunned by his response, attempting once again to make clear that the kingdom of heaven is a spiritual kingdom to be established in the hearts of men, not as a reign of glory. After taking inventory of the group's assets, Jesus established the practice of 2 weeks fishing for their material support and 2 weeks personal ministry. Jesus alternated fishing with two apostles at a time, during which time they grew to love him so. This alternating of activities continued for more than 5 months. And here ends my summary.
All right. Thank you, Kermit. For those of us who were not able to attend last week's show, we very much appreciate you summarizing what was said there. Although there's no substitute for listening to the whole episode for those of you who are inclined and you have the time. But symmetryofsoul.org is where we keep all of Kermit's written summaries available for inspection at later dates. Very good. Well, I had one thought on my mind. It's kind of been percolating for a few weeks, but still as good a time as any to bring up. Although first I want to see if we have any technical clarifications or anything that really jumps out from Kermit's review since you all were there last week.
Nothing technical, but yeah, if it's okay to make some comments before you put forward your thoughts there, Brad.
Mm-hmm.
When you kind of sort of asked the rhetorical question towards the beginning of the review there, Kermit, about what kind of growth, and you're talking about man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. And we, you know, in that context, we were pointing out the relationship of growth to righteousness. One way, you know, that you directly see them bringing up that point in the Revelation is when you go to the section on the seven psychic circles. You'll notice that they use a singular, it's a singular time they use the expression in their soul growth. They're, towards the beginning of that section, they're wanting to try to emphasize the very holistic nature of the process that's being demarked by these so-called psychic circles. You know, as opposed to some, partial phase, instead of saying something like spiritual growth, for instance, you know, to use that expression soul growth to stress the very holistic nature of this quote-unquote growth that you're speaking of, of how you're being grown. And we all know that they also refer to those psychic circles, if you don't use that parallel analogy to the central universe of moving inward in with quote-unquote circles, you know, to think of it more directly, right, as moving up cosmic levels.
Right.
Right. And since righteousness is conformity with the cosmos, right, if you're moving up cosmic levels, right, you have ascending conformity with the cosmos, you have ascending righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
That growth is righteousness. We'll see it, exactly what you were bringing up in the review, Kermit, a great little foreshadowing reminder of what we're going to talk about, the key items in Section 8 here when we get started on Section 8, these issues about the how the Hebrews, the Jews, and how still today we struggle with this issue of righteousness, being something about the outer life. And something that can be, hence, directly assessed. When we talk about conformity with the cosmos, I don't know of any measuring device that gives me some readout of 9.2 units of cosmosness. That's a very intangible thing to consider, observing, measuring in the outer life. It's very much trying to get us to recognize that this is an inner life fact. If we can keep stressing that, as we'll see Jesus is trying to do 2,000 years ago, it can improve the, our tendency because of the old wineskins to have a very inappropriate knee-jerk reaction to the word righteousness.
Yes.
It's been so colored over the centuries, the millennia, by outer life debasement of concept that it's very difficult to see it anew. And as I was stressing last week, as you were reminding us in the review, we were talking up front, to have such a transformative reformation of conception about the term righteousness, that the term love can be a phase of righteousness. Not to mention the need for a reformation of the word symbol love, but that when both are reformed, they come together in a way that was heretofore not imaginable. So there's so much recognition, so much revelatory recognition just waiting to dawn in our minds if we can challenge ourselves to not feel the material gravity, that drags concepts and words down, in our, unavoidable, ties to past thought.
Well, it's very apropos that you bring this up with the word righteous, because my comment was pretty much the same thing, but about a different word. First, let me say that those of us who were children of the 80s have a particularly difficult time with the word righteous, because that was one of the slang terms that was out there.
Yeah.
Ferris is a righteous dude, Ferris Bueller's
right.
Day Off. I doubt it. Maybe, but he's like 15 and he's a slacker, so I don't know.
That's not unlike, a woo-woo use of the word cosmic, right?
Right. That was another 80s slang, cosmic dude, So we're steeped in that. But speaking of these terms with all this baggage, and speaking of last week's reading with the old wineskins, the old forms, I recently, in my sequential read-through of the Urantia book, whatever number I'm on now, got to the so-called religion papers, right around paper 100, 101, 102. And it's such a cheap trick, but I tried it, and I tried it consistently. I'm reading these papers to myself with my internal voice, not out loud. I'm not prescribing this for anyone, but instead of saying to myself the word religion, I just pronounced it different. Religion, as in like ligament and binding. And it, for me, as an old high school band nerd, it conjured up images of the ligature on the clarinet and the saxophone, the thing that binds the reed to the instrument. And just that subtle change of emphasis on a different syllable was able to clear up some waters. I was able to see those papers anew just by emphasizing a different syllable. Again, it's not a magic trick. It's just I have a lot of baggage with the word religion. I grew up in the American South in the 1980s. There's a lot that goes along with that, and I found myself a little bit, at least verbally, liberated from that, free from that, I should say, by just suggesting a different pronunciation. In effect, coining a new word where the word is not actually new, but I try to treat it like it.
That's fascinating, Brad, because, we all have this baggage, these old wineskins, and we can learn what we've been learning, but to use that technique is very intriguing. I think that's really a great idea. Just to get us into a different, little bit different mindset. And that word religion, you're so right. I can't say the word religion around my kids without them recoiling, like, oh, do you have to say that word? Come up with anything but that. It's like, good
mm-hmm.
Lord.
Yeah. And how incredibly problematic that is. The fact that word has so much baggage. You could say in a nutshell, that's why the revelation is here. Right? The fact that people are viscerally recoiling from the concept of being bound back to eternity.
Right.
Would suffer anything but that. Yeah, I mean, that's a thought that dooms civilizations, you know, and can eventually doom the individual.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a cataclysmic bias. If you just absolutely refuse to be bound back to eternity, well, guess what? You're sovereign, and you get your wish.
Yeah.
Right? And the fruits of darkness, you know, that internally fulfill your wish pour out into the world, and civilization goes dark.
But you know, to put it in perspective, they hear the word religion and they think evolutionary religion with all of its death and destruction that's been, you know, happened in its wake.
Maybe we should coin some, you know, silly expression about babies in bathwater.
There you go.
Yeah, right, right.
You see, that's, again, it doesn't matter, you know, how much we can understand and rationalize it, you know, and see if think there's a validity there. Okay, when all is said and done, it's cataclysmic. You know, ignorance can have stark consequences. You know, immature assumptions can have stark consequences. It's not because, God, you know, has no grace and, you know, he's easily slighted. Right? So if you, you know, do some triviality, he gives you the thumbs down. It's just, you know, even little things in the hands of someone who has a sovereign free will can have huge consequences. Right? And not even God can change that. He gave you the ability to eternalize your trivialities. So, you know, FYI.
Yeah. Well,
to be recognized. I mean, the personal responsibility is inescapable, right? It's just you have to face this fact that, you know, no amount of love, you know, from God changes the fact that, you know, you're in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not to digress too long, but since I brought the topic up of baggage with the word religion and everything, I had about a 5 or 6 year period where I was in the wilderness, away from the Urantia book. It was hibernating. It was my own so-called dark ages, I guess. But it was pretty striking, some of the ideas that I held. You know, seeing organizations as you drive along, like businesses that are known to have a religion at their founding, or particularly religious executives, I recoiled. I mocked them. Places that would be closed on Sundays, I would mock that. All those things happen, and I guess I'm just, you know, I've had to come to terms with that, live with that. You know, I came back into the fold, the prodigal son, as it were, the lost sheep, maybe a little more appropriate. I didn't have a lot of money to spend, but you know, I wouldn't trade that experience away, because now I have the direct experience of what it's like out there to mock what faint glimmers of overt religious feeling, you know, leaking into the outer life there are in civilization. I became a part of the darkening for a few years and was patted on the back, said, you know, way to go, welcome to the fold.
Welcome to the enlightened ones. And it's like, no, that would be the opposite.
That would be the opposite, yeah. You're going, you get, you know. Yeah.
And, you know, and just as you read Psalm 1, you know, it's right there in Psalm 1:1, exactly, right, what you're describing, you unwittingly got sucked into.
Yeah.
Right? If blessed is the man that sits not in the seat of the scornful, well then, how you describe the man that sits in the seat of the scornful?
Mm.
Cursed is the man.
That was That would be a fair assessment in retrospect of those 4 to 5 years. That looking back, that's what they felt like going through it. Of course, that tension is what brought me back to all of this, a little bit of a renaissance after the Dark Ages. I wouldn't trade it away, but boy, is it dark. I would not wish that upon anyone. Of course, I don't have to. There are millions upon millions of people already there.
Yeah, delighting in it, you know, to their own end. And again, it's exactly the kind of thing I was just pointing out. I mean, it's not like you've got this God on high, this all-seeing eye. It's like, oh, you know, I'm waiting for Brad to, you know, make, you know, fun of me, you know, some little petty slight, and I'm going to throw him into the abyss. No, that's not what's going on.
No.
No, it's just you know, because you have a sovereign free will, you know, if you choose to sit in the seat of the scornful, you spiritualize that. Your adjuster copies that into the soul. And what does that copy look like? A sledgehammer whacking off of a chunk of your soul. You do that, not God. No thumbs down from God going on. You know, that is seemingly trivial in the grand scheme of things as the word scornful might strike you as.
Right.
Again, but it's in my absolute sovereign free will hands, that scorn. Right? And, you know, so this, you know, that's the thing that's so important about that first verse. It's talking about how, you know, it's not so much directly you originating, but you choosing to align, see, so that it's your will that someone else's wicked will be done. See, you didn't originate the wicked will.
No.
But you willed your conformity with it. And so now it is your will that their wicked will be done. So that, you know, it's not that we're, you know, we have guilt by association. That's not what that verse is about. You know, you are choosing, right? It is my will that their wicked will be done. Right? It's not, you know, guilt by association. You know, it's not, hereditary sin or something like that.
Right.
No, it's in the moment you're choosing. It's your choice. Your volition is unfortunate. Right? And that has, you know, a potentially eternal consequence. Anything that you will has a potentially eternal consequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to shake the idea that some of those experiences, those of those 4 to 5 years, will always be with me, something of the essence of them. You know, whether it's a permanent scar or something, that, you know, that remains to be seen. It's not my business right now. But they were formative, and now looking back, they are striking. So, you know.
It may take until the third mansion world to, you know, to transcend, you know, that scarring. It can be transcended, but
yeah.
To think that it's just a passing triviality, it's like, well, not if you put your... Not if you spiritualized it, put your will into play.
Yeah.
Then it gets copied into your soul, and you pick up with that when you start in the first mansion world. So, you know, it's just, you know, and to not be afraid of this, but just to understand that, you know, God has given you this great gift of free will. Now, sober yourself to, you know, to what that implies. Don't shoot yourself in the foot with it.
Well, thanks for letting me talk that through. That's been simmering there for a little while, but there we go.
I mean, as long as we brought up Psalm 1, I could just mention, you know, I couldn't help but notice in the translation you were reading, you know, one can note that the revelators, you know, give some validation to the way it's translated in the King James. You know, and as you reflect on it, you can understand, you know, that if you translate that first, you know, color, if you will, in that first verse as wicked, well, then the next one is sinners. It's like, well, wait a minute, those are synonyms. You know, so, you know, having that first one be, you know, to walk not in the counsel of the ungodly rather than the wicked.
Yeah.
Right. See, so that, you know, you appreciate that, you know, that's, in other words, the evil, right? To
right.
walk not in the counsel of the evil, you know, nor stand in the way of sinners. Right? So then you can see, oh, it's, you know, it's not, you know, muddled together. It's a distinction, and, you know, and it's pointing out, you know that. It can start very small. Like in the third one, it's a scornful. And, or you can take it up a notch to the evil. Or you can take it all the way to the sinners. But, you know, see, when it's your free will spiritualizing, right, it's a quality issue, not a quantity issue. And it's, there's no quality difference between, you know, whether it's sparked by the, you know, by scorn or by ungodliness, you know, or even wickedness. You know, you take it to a full willful consecration. Right? I mean, it's the, you know, it's why Jesus' mustard seed, you know, analogy was valid. Right? It doesn't have to be huge to begin with. Right? Because it's spiritualized, you know, because you're spiritualizing, it's not like material where it's a purely quantity thing.
Yeah.
Right? And the gravity of the sun is greater than the gravity of our moon.
Spirit gravity works a little differently.
Yeah. Right. That, and so, you know, to recognize how it's important to, you know, that you've been given discriminators, right? With your encirclement of the Holy Spirit, so that you can notice the little mustard seed. Right? You can you know, parse things and find those fine distinctions, because you need to. Because what you're going to engage, right? It will latch on to the so-called small, just as consequentially as the so-called large. It's like a mustard seed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all, you know, to be able to think through, you know, exactly, you know, why is it that, you know, the Holy Spirit has this kind of, you know, very fine microscope ability. Right? I mean, you know, why do I need that? Because it's dealing with spirit, not matter. And the physics is different. But anyway, right, it's just, you know, it's so easy to, you know, to find yourself walking in the counsel of the ungodly. Right? That's just, especially when you're in a secular society, right, and there's clamoring for, you know, your identification with some movement. Well,
never,
you know,
been easier.
Extremely likely, right, that, you know, they want you to walk in the counsel of them, the ungodly. Right, when you can't even say religion, pretty likely that the ungodly are quite common out there, is it not?
For sure.
Yeah.
That's what
and it doesn't matter how, you know, how much their counsel is, quote-unquote, the wisdom of the world. It's the counsel of the ungodly. See, and spiritually, that's the you know, the issue. You need to judge it spiritually, not materially. It doesn't matter how much it seems. You can make a material argument for, you know, following this counsel. It's like, no, no, you do not want to follow that. That's the counsel of the ungodly.
But when it comes to your own children or anybody that you love, I just don't know how to communicate in a way that would make any darn difference, if not maybe even make it worse. So I just pretty much keep my mouth closed.
Again, I mean, it's, you know, once a human comes into existence, you know, there's an independent path before them. None of us can see to the destiny of anyone else. The destiny is in the hands of each individual, absolutely. Right? Not even God, right, has a say, right, in the destiny of every individual. Right? I mean, our personality is absolutely unique.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, who can overlap and influence with that? No one. So, you know, it's, you have to just, you know, trust in God. You have to let things be as they are. I mean, you know, we can all, you know, try to have our fruits be potentially an influence. You know, remember that, you know, in the loyalty sense of the tadpole, right? That it might, you know, our unspoken consecration, our unspoken loyalty, you know, can slip under someone's radar, right? And touch upon their encirclement in the Holy Spirit and open a closed eye within, perhaps. Right? But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's nothing any of us can do to pry someone's eye open.
Right.
You know, and that's where trust in God comes in. You have to, you know, we want to try to do something. It's like, no, you got to trust. It all is, you know, all will come out as it needs to.
Yeah.
And you know, the revelation is just full of assurances of giving every ascending soul every opportunity. Seeing the truth and choosing the righteous path, and you know the wrongdoer is given ample opportunity to discover their own true desires and natures. Do they really want to go down that road? You know, this world is very devoid of authoritative guidance when it comes to spiritual matters, and so it. I would imagine there are many waking up on the mansion world entirely dislocated spiritually who just were never given the proper training or exposure to the truths. And so that's what the mansion worlds are for that redemption and for remediation.
You know, the fullness of grace to have a way to play out. Like you said,
yeah.
Kermit, especially when you're talking about a benighted sphere like ours, right? Where it's just,
right.
You know, it's so difficult to not become jaded by the arbitrariness of voices, you know, about, you know, what's right and what's wrong.
Exactly.
Well, and it's,
you know,
like,
and to kind of just give up on all that.
It's like what we read last week about Jesus is not here to save the righteous, but the sinners. So it's all about them.
Yeah,
and see, and technically, you know, as you know from other places, you know, like we pointed out, you know, obviously, if someone is literally, right, in the real sense of sinner, a sinner, it'd be wonderful if they could, you know, turn themselves around and, you know, in the presence of Jesus' ministry. But so often, you know, you're just meaning what, you know, the Jews of that day called sinners, you know, which is Jesus point out, is technically they're just lost, right? You know, he's constantly using that analogy
right.
of someone is lost, right? You know, it's just they've just lost touch with their inner life. You know, they haven't, you know, literally, you know, set up camp in there, you know, in a creatively, you know, consecrating it to darkness. They've just
right.
lost touch with their inner life. You know, and because they've lost touch with their inner life, they're doing things that the culture of the day, you know, deemed to be sinful. But it's actually just lost. Right? And you know, that's why it says what it does, you know, towards the end of the Revelation. Right? Jesus recognized for most, you know, they're more weak than wicked. You know, more distraught
right.
than depraved. Right? We don't want to lose sight of that. That's still, you know, a very common circumstance. But, you know, on the other hand, we need to remind ourselves that something's going on 2,000 years since Jesus, you know, that's different, that's created this emergency that's led to an emergency epical revelation being given to us. And I tried to point that out. It's because there's been an evolution of our nature. We're innately more spiritualizing of our mind. It's more difficult to be merely weak, you know, or merely distraught. You know, it's much easier to start putting that stuff under actual personality management, to spiritualize it, and lift weakness up into wickedness. So, you know, it's important that we're given this heads up. You know, it's important that we're told that, you know, our thought adjuster is a mystery monitor, right? A divine secret that warns, right? It's there to try to boost that little warning in your mind that, you know, you need to be careful. You know, it's much easier for you than someone 2,000 years ago to spiritualize your weakness and make it full-on wickedness. Right? So keep an eye on yourself. Have the courage to take yourself under precise management. It's just said in countless ways throughout the Revelation to try to get us to know that we have a job. You can't just rest on the laurels of grace. Like that's why the sheltered bay, you know, analogy.
Right.
You're just not in the sheltered bay anymore. It is you will spiritualize stuff now in a way that, you know, those back in the sheltered bay days just didn't do almost ever. You know, it was really difficult to flail so violently in the blue lagoon that you drowned yourself. But it takes almost nothing to drown on the high seas. That's the difference. You know, they tell us over and over in countless ways, like I said, and just to keep that in mind. You know, the Supreme is trying to move this world from that phase where we progress in spite of ourselves, right, the sheltered bay, to that domain where we progress because of ourselves. The Supreme is trying to move us in that transition, which means that everyone now has much more of a personal play here. You know, it's just that endless fact that, you know, from him to whom much is given, much will be expected. You know, so, you know, we can wish for progress. Oh, I wish the, I wish the you continue to have the adjutants dawning in the collective, and wow, wouldn't it be wonderful, you know, to have encirclement of the Holy Spirit, you know, be a collective sort of a phenomenon because of the collective mode of the seventh adjutant, and you know, and wouldn't it be wonderful if we had, you know, subsequent, you know, sons of God come and say, well, everything that you're given, more will be required of you. So be careful what you ask for. Okay? It's not what our you know, ease-seeking souls, you know, are envisioning. It's like, oh, man, then I would have to do almost nothing. It would all just be, you know, the land of milk and honey.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people think about some new visitation, that it would make life easier, but you're right, it wouldn't.
But the more spiritual a world becomes, the more everything is the path of greatest resistance. Now, the material world is the path of least resistance. You know, and it's just, that's not the dreams, you know, of our animal origin minds when they talk about things being more spiritual. We're imagining, you know, that spiritual means you make the material frictionless. No.
Yeah.
That's not what spiritual means.
Well, lest there be any doubt, and I don't think there is any doubt among the longtime listeners on Symmetry of Soul, the interpretation or sphere of interpretation under which we operate here at Symmetry of Soul is not in the mainstream even of the study groups and the so-called Urantia movement at whole. It seems to me like the bulk of Urantia book readers think of it as a sort of a spiritual tranquilizing dart. Everything is going to be okay. All you need is love, and on we could go. And, you know, some of that fear not stuff is appropriate, but there are a lot of people who have overplayed that, who have worn out their sheets of paper in the spheres of light and life, and they've, like, not read any of the other papers, and they've just have wish fulfillment fantasies about light and life, and that's not what we're about here. We're about all 196 papers and the foreword, trying to see what are these people, these beings, telling us.
And they're giving us, you know, wonderful, you know, gifts to validate our hope. Right, but at the same time, they're giving us very direct statements to, you know, dispel all of our false wishful thinking.
Yes.
You know, and so it, you know, it's very vigorous at times, right? And it's not because they're trying to, you know, rip the hope out of you. They're trying to rip the false, you know, wishful thinking out of you, right? So that you can actually build your house upon rock instead of sand, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Your house will be so much better for it, but you'll have to maybe tear down whatever you were building. Yeah.
Because it's just not going to serve you well. You know, you've got this wonderful little craft, you know, that is just perfect for the Blue Lagoon. Right? But it's instantly just shredded on the high seas.
Pile of matchsticks, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a stand-up paddleboard.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good luck in the middle of the Pacific Ocean there. it's just they love us. The revelators love us. Right? They have a desire to do good for us. Right? But, you know, there is a tough aspect to real love. Right? We need to let go of that which will not serve us well. But our ignorance, you know, is telling us that, oh, this is going to be great. It's like, no, you must let go of that. You must refound your life. All right. Well, so that just to, like I said, you know, we'll see here shortly. We'll pick this very topic up just a tad again here. You know, because it's very, you know, fundamental to, as we're about to see very directly, to what Jesus is trying to do in his prelude. He's trying to do his best to get his apostles to start this shift so that they can begin to build a worldview that's, you know, that's predicated on the rock of the Isle of Paradise. It's predicated on a real inner life. And it's just, we all know, he struggled and struggled with this to try to get them to make that transition to you know, just to the concept of the kingdom. It's like, no, you know, Jeremy just reminded us, we touched upon it again, you know, as he brought out in the review. It's like, no. The kingdom is not an outer life term. It's an inner life term. Right? And they all just look at him, you know, and then turn, look at each other. What is he talking about? I don't know. But he keeps trying.
For years, he keeps trying, yes. Yeah. All right. Let's commence. It's paper 138 of the Urantia Papers, Training the Kingdom's Messengers. We are in Section 8 of that paper tonight, called First Work of the Twelve. You'll find that on page 1545 of the original single-column publication of the papers, known as the Urantia Book. After disposing of the fish catches of 2 weeks, Judas Iscariot, the one chosen to act as treasurer of the 12, divided the apostolic funds into 6 equal portions, funds for the care of dependent families having been already provided. And then, near the middle of August in the year AD 26, they went forth 2 and 2 to the fields of work assigned by Andrew. The first 2 weeks, Jesus went out with Andrew and Peter. The second 2 weeks with James and John, and so on with the other couples in the order of their choosing. In this way, he was able to go out at least once with each couple before he called them together for the beginning of their public ministry.
Yeah.
Quite organized.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be, you know, what I want to point out is again, all of this material pragmatism, all of this order, right, that's this very essential to this prelude, and notice that final statement, you know, is literally speaking to the fact that we are wrapping up the prelude, right? Call them together before he called them together for the beginning of their public ministry. We're getting very close now, right? We're doing the final finishing touches of the prelude, and notice as Kermit was bringing out in the review, it's like, oh, now we've got 8 apostles, now we've got 10 apostles. Yeah. Notice that, yeah, you know, now we can finally use that term, the 12.
The 12.
And going forward, right, see, now that you literally have 12, you know, sometimes, you know, that term, you know, is abstracted from the literalness of the count, right? And they'll just use the expression the 12 to mean the apostles. And it
right.
may not literally be the case that at that particular moment, you know, in that particular setting, you know, there's 12 of them, right? You know, but the 12 of them have become the 12, right?
Not to digress on this, right. But that there is one of those little famous points of contention. Maybe you're referring to it. You know, somewhere late, much later in the book, where they refer to the 12 apostles, but there's only 11 present because Judas is just affected And people have had such strong feelings about that. Some have talked about changing the text of the book. So it's...
Oh, dear.
That's why I'm stressing this right now. Yep. Again, to not be so simplistic, you know, see, and materially arithmetic, as I was just trying to stress about, you know, the mustard seed analogy, right? You know, to think in, you know, in more sophisticated terms. We all know you made it through those early grades and you can count. Okay, but can you take your mind above, you know, learning how to count? Think in more mature terms about the use of language. It's not a trivial issue, because if you can't begin to do that, you'll never figure out what the word truth refers to. You've got to get a long distance from the fact of now there's one, now there's two, now there's three, to get to the truth. See, so, you know, there's, you know, in a very simplistic way, you know, you are kind of hinting at the truth of the apostles, right, by taking the term the 12 and making it perhaps sometimes independent of the literal count. Technically right as the fact, but everlastingly wrong in the truth. That line. It starts with all kinds of simple things like this. Right? Not getting your, you know, be a truth seeker, not a fact finder only. Right? Truth seeker first, then you will truly find facts. But if you start as merely a fact finder, you'll never know the truth. You'll be technically right as the facts and everlastingly wrong in the truth. If you try to do it the other direction, you know, and notice that it's just, you know, you get everything or nothing. So depending on which direction you go, it's very reciprocal like that, as we always talk about. So just, you know, that's the point of me seeing if everyone can challenge themselves to not be, don't be an automaton, don't be a machine. You know, reflect upon the revelation. Don't just parse its words like you were an optical character reader.
And when you parse them and fail to detect a discernible meaning, don't just give up and say, well, the text must be wrong or something. Yeah.
Approach it from the top down, because that only then can you, you know, properly assess truth and falsehood. Right? You know, saying I found an error. I bet you think you found an error, but you approached it from the bottom up, didn't you? Yeah. Well, that's not possible. You can't know error from the bottom up. You can only know error from the top down. You could find a typo from the bottom up. You're not going to find an error from the bottom up.
All right. Well,
little did you know that the 12 could be made, so much could be made of it.
I know. Just the title of the section, the 12, yeah. All right. It also made me think, we'll move on here, just, you know, every epical revelation, there seems to be some pattern of, as Ecclesiastes, as Solomon would say, a time to gather stones, a time to scatter stones. Every epical revelation has a time where the teachers or the trainers or the center of instruction is somehow built and consolidated and put together. It's either, maybe it's Salem, maybe it's Dalmatia, maybe it's Eden. Maybe it's the 12 apostles, but then eventually comes a time, and it always comes, it takes longer than the impatient would want it to be. Then it's time to send the people out. And I don't have the answer, but it certainly seems like we have an epical revelation here, and one ought to pause and say, does that pattern apply here with this book, and what does that mean? But that's a whole other show to itself right there. But You see the pattern here. Meticulous, organized, 5-month period of fishing and ministering. Fishing and ministering. Yeah. Jesus taught them to preach the forgiveness of sin through faith in God without penance or sacrifice, and that the Father in heaven loves all his children with the same eternal love. He enjoined his apostles to refrain from discussing, 1, the work and imprisonment of John the Baptist, 2, the voice at the baptism. Said Jesus, only those who heard the voice may refer to it. Speak only that which you have heard from me. Speak not hearsay. 3, the turning of the water into wine at Cana. Jesus seriously charged them, saying, tell no man about the water and the wine.
Yeah, so before we deal with that first sentence, which is what I was hinting at earlier about picking up that baton again that we were talking about up front, you know, let's look at that list of three. The one that definitely struck me as I was, looking at them again is Jesus seriously charged them. To emphasize that seriously, tell no man. And of course, the more it's, quote unquote, a miracle, right, the more that's all anyone wants to talk about. Right? And seeing of all the things they're stressing, that one, okay, there's no qualification like there is for number two. It's like, well, okay, if you were actually there, you may refer to it. Okay, but the other one, it's like, no, it doesn't matter if you're there, not there, whatever, not at all. And it's the one that everyone wants to talk about the most. That's what Jesus wants them to talk about the least. Why? Why is he opposite to our natural proclivities? Is he not here as a religious uplifter, and genuine religion is the unnatural? It's predicated on the inner life, not the natural outer life. The natural outer life, like I said, that's the path of least resistance. The inner life, that's the path of greatest resistance.
Yeah.
Very unnatural. See?
Well, and he knew that there was such a big chance of it becoming about him. And he figures that every little thing that gets out there is going to create an exponential ripple down through the ages. So he knows how important these little things are.
Yeah, he's trying to get them to discover the inner life in contrast to the outer life. Well, he's got this big problem, himself, this very shiny object in their outer lives.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, good luck, Jesus, getting them to not notice it you at all, to be Jesus forgetting. remember, worship is self-forgetting.
Right.
Yeah. So how much more problematic is that going to be when, part of the whole outer life of that self that you need to forget, it's got Jesus playing in it.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. Right? And if I calculate, what word occurs, most frequently in the Urantia book, we all know what word it is. The very shiny object that we're supposed to not start with. But in a word cloud, there it is.
There it is. There it is.
Jesus. Right?
Yeah. Andrea, I agree with you that these three instructions here were very practical. Like, well, if they talk about it, it's going to spread. It's going to have implications, consequences throughout the ages. But I think what I'm hearing, you say, Chris, and I think I agree with this, this is a little bit of a more of a inward-facing challenge to the apostles. Like, as much as you might want to talk about the wedding at Cana, don't. And if you ever feel like you need to, confer with your brethren here and talk about it. Now, you can imagine them just sitting around the campfire like, oh, earlier today I so wanted to talk about the water and the wine. Why do you think he's telling us to not do that? And there's an opportunity for reflection among the 12 if they'll listen to what he's saying here.
Yeah, that's true, Brad.
Yeah, and you
so that reminds me.
Oh, go ahead.
It reminds me of, you know, Jesus wasn't around after the resurrection and ascension, and the first thing that they started off with was the risen and glorified Christ. Resurrection, far more attractive to talk about and amazing to contemplate than sonship with God and brotherhood of man. So they didn't learn their lesson.
Very good.
If he'd given these three after, the ascension, would have been, and whatever you do, don't talk about, my resurrection.
Right. That was the first thing they did, and that's all they wanted to hear about.
Right.
From the dead.
I mean, the only thing that could keep them from, not talking about the water and the wine was his resurrection. Yeah, it's like, no, that's worse. But the other thing too, just the challenge to not be natural. Speak not hearsay.
Yeah.
But no.
Yeah, that's just good. That's just common sense or good advice. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But again, it's very natural to gossip.
Very.
Yeah. So again, just to see him in those lights, and of course, to move on and not kind of be tied back to John the Baptist, is number one. Again, there's a lot of naturalness there too. So just, you could make a lot of comments on these, but I thought just emphasizing that mode of it, right? He's always going to be challenging them to be unnatural, and that bit at the beginning, right? That he taught them to preach the forgiveness of sin through faith in God without penance or sacrifice, and that the Father in heaven loves all His children with the same eternal love. Okay, so he's definitely, right, in the fourth epical revelation, wanting to put forward the God of love.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so he's got that in there. But notice that, as we pointed out, he's going to keep things, kind of in the, revivified by Melchizedek, post-Adamic mode, right, the Most High God, and so when he says he taught them to preach forgiveness of sin through faith in God, without penance or sacrifice. In other words, go out and preach what Melchizedek said. Right? Yeah. That part is just the gospel of Melchizedek. Right? That's the Melchizedek gospel of trust in God and salvation through faith. Salvation through faith. He can easily keep everyone sort of properly grounded in what that word faith means, that it doesn't just mean belief, right? It means believe God's promises and follow His instructions. Right? So that basic Melchizedek mode. And for those who are, haven't looked those passages up, the believe God's promises and follow His instructions. That's in 93:6-4. The Melchizedek gospel of trust in God and salvation through faith. That's 94:1-6. Those very basic ways of starting to have an inner life and righteousness-based sense of the word faith. And, he's not going to try to, push that too much further forward. He's going to try to bring in the God of love,
Yeah.
Right? Right? So that it's, you know, he can try to, you know, get them to move beyond the first epical revelation, right, with, you know, the fear of the Lord.
Yeah.
And we can talk about, you know, that whole issue. It's like, well, Jesus, are you sure you should do that? I mean, there was a rebellion and a default, and you skipped the magisterial son. I mean, is it safe to talk about the love of, you know, the God of love? Right, there's that whole issue. But, nonetheless, we trust his wisdom. Okay, and he did it. He did what he did 2,000 years ago. But that doesn't change the fact that he's still encouraging them to start with that Melchizedek foundation. He taught them to preach the forgiveness of sin through faith in God without penance or sacrifice.
They had wonderful times throughout these 5 or 6 months, during which they worked as fishermen every alternate 2 weeks, thereby earning enough money to support themselves in the field for each succeeding 2 weeks of missionary work for the kingdom.
Yeah, to just, you know, we can, one thing maybe we should mention, since we've been saying 5 months, notice they say 5 or 6. It kind of depends on whether you include some of the stuff a little bit before. But, you know, that little technicality. But this, you know, again, this very material pragmatism combined with spiritual idealism. In this case, you can, you know, literally alternate 2 weeks sort of mode of let's open this eye. Okay, now let's open the other eye. Now let's open this eye. But trying to, you know, how important it is to have your, you know, especially if he's going to try to them to be all the more literally spiritual, you know, and engage the inner life, you know, it's very important then to have, you know, a material pragmatism grounded outer life so that there's law and order. And if you try to get them fully into love and service predicated on a separate from that inner life, you might lose the law and order of the outer life, and that's a catastrophe. Right? That's that whole issue of telling them about the God of love. Is that safe, Jesus? Right? Are you going to lose law and order? Are you going to get anarchy? But nonetheless, you know, we just see it over and over again. All this order and all this material pragmatism, upheld.
It's worth slowing down and studying instead of breezing through with only your spirit eye open. Ah, this is the boring stuff. I don't want to hear about logistics and meeting agendas and you know, chairmen and treasurers. I get to the parables. Well, all right. There's a reason for all this. The common people marveled at the teaching and ministry of Jesus and his apostles. The rabbis had long taught the Jews that the ignorant could not be pious or righteous. But Jesus' apostles were both pious and righteous. Yet they were cheerfully ignorant of much of the learning of the rabbis and the wisdom of the world.
Okay, here's some additional little chewy bits. You know, one thing you notice there is, that tendency, you know, going back prior to, you know, the exile in Babylon, you know, amongst the Hebrews, that tendency to get very secularized. What you abhor is intellectual ignorance. Right? Long taught the Jews that the ignorant could not be. That's secularism coming in. You know, even though, you know, you're talking about pious or righteous, right? Where, you know, it seems like what you're abhorring is iniquity. But just, you know, that whole bit about the learning of the rabbis, seeing the wisdom of the world. So you've got that issue that you can see there. And then what Jesus is trying to do, and how that's already being kind of recognized. You go, wait a minute, they're pious and righteous, but I thought by definition they couldn't be pious and righteous, you know, in this whole befogged by much thinking mode. What's going on? Well, Jesus is trying to get righteous from the outer life to the inner life. And if you do that, you know, your piety is born again. Right? You know, that outer life piety, you know, is still observable, but now it's predicated on an inner life righteousness. So you notice pious and righteousness, the righteousness being the foundational word there. Whereas they're all blurred together, as they're about to point out in the next paragraph, right, in these Jews, these religious leaders, you know, this whole, you know, it's like, well, okay, what's your you know, what's your distinction between piety and righteousness? It's like a distinction of, you know, a very fine distinction. It's like, well, there's the purity of my outer life righteousness. That's my piety. It's almost no difference at all in their minds.
They were cheerfully ignorant.
So just right there, you know, Jesus is trying to move righteousness from the outer life to the inner life, you know, and have this whole conception of piety and righteousness be transformed. You know, and he seems the common people are their gears are turning a little bit. You know, it's like they're not rejecting. It's like, well, that's not piety or righteousness. I go, well, no, I think that is. That's weird. Analytically, I can't figure out why I think it is. But see, their encirclement in the Holy Spirit, their insight is saying that no, that's real. And then they could figure out, they could analyze it subsequently, maybe sort out an understanding. But gee, you know, that transformation, that's what's going on there.
All right, Andrea, would you like to take the reading from here?
Sure. Thank you, Brad. Let me know if you can hear me okay.
All right.
Jesus made plain to his apostles the difference between the repentance of so-called good works as taught by the Jews and the change of mind by faith, the new birth which he required as the price of admission to the kingdom. He taught his apostles that faith was the only requisite to entering the Father's kingdom. John had taught them repentance to flee from the wrath to come. Jesus taught faith is the open door for entering into the present, perfect, and eternal love of God. Jesus did not speak like a prophet, one who comes to declare the word of God. He seemed to speak of himself as one having authority. Jesus sought to divert their minds from miracle-seeking to the finding of a real and personal experience in the satisfaction and assurance of the indwelling of God's Spirit of love and saving grace.
Yeah, so you know, you definitely see, you know, all of this emphasis try to recast things, bringing in the God of love. But you know, you have that foundational issue still of challenging their outer life notion of righteousness, works righteousness, right? Very literally, right? So-called good works, right? So challenging that outer life works righteousness, you know, taking it to the inner life and, you know, literally being born again, right, by that faith grasp, the inner life, augmenting, you know, that, when you're grabbing the divine law in the inner life, when you're, the concept of the divine law, when you're grabbing, that literally the fact of God, you're also grabbing the fact that God is love. Right? He's trying to add that addition. And then as we pointed out, in the fullness, you can understand how real love is, right? Is a phase of, the righteousness. Right? It's a divine ideal of the divine law. Right? But just as a beginning step, kind of a fourth epical mode, right? Just adding in that, that fact of God that you're grasping with your faith grasp in the inner life, and is a being who loves you. He's not the volcano God.
Yeah, that's the evolutionary idea there. Bring it forward.
Yeah, but very much. None of this discussion of love, the God of love, is divorced from the predicate of righteousness.
Right.
And that's what that's. As long as that doesn't happen, everything is okay. But if you let yourself float off, like we were just saying, if you let the spiritual idealism of thinking about the love of God separate you from the material pragmatism of law and order, then you're going to have issues.
I feel like sometimes no small part of what we do here on Symmetry of Soul is discuss what effectively might be prerequisites for a proper reading and studying of the Urantia book. I mean, light stuff like, knowing the entire lower hemisphere of philosophy, having a working knowledge of the Bible, that would really help. Being arrayed, understanding the law of God, law and order, before focusing on the love of God. And myself included, I think most of us fall pretty short on this list of prerequisites.
Let's see now. So is the Urantia book big? Yeah, it's kind of a big tome. Huh, I wonder if from him to whom much is given, much will be expected.
Huh, yeah. I wonder. Right.
It's inescapable. It's always there. Right? The bigger the book, right, the more is going to be expected of you. Right? It's a predicate. That taking on that challenge. And if you're going to not just put it in your old wineskins and have it be a revelation of error, there's a whole bunch of prerequisites. You don't get truth automatically. There's only error if you skip the prerequisites. You have to do your part. Whether you think about that like the lower hemisphere parts, because it's the upper hemisphere, or however you think about that analogy, you have something's expected of you in advance. Right? You don't get an adjuster without prerequisites. Right? I mean, the whole universe is like that. I mean, there's a downreach, yes. Good news, there's a downreach, but it only comes halfway down, and you have to supply the other half, the upreach. That's the way everything works. You don't get to spring with just the mother. That's the downreach, right? There has to be an equal bottom half upreach, the Almighty, in order to get to supreme. You can talk about it in every way, shape, and form.
That makes sense, though.
Yeah, you don't just have one of the fifth and sixth triunities. You have both of them. One's a downreach, one's an upreach. I mean, it's everywhere. It's just recognizing that pattern, and then it's like, oh my goodness, you mean I'm responsible for half of what's required? Yep. And the bigger the upper half given, the bigger the lower half that's expected of you that's required.
This is a big book. I guess we better get busy.
Serious student.
Yep. Okay. The disciples early learned that the master had a profound respect and sympathetic regard for every human being he met, and they were tremendously impressed
by this uniform and unvarying consideration which he so consistently gave to all sorts of men, women, and children. He would pause in the midst of a profound discourse that he might go out in the road to speak good cheer to a woman passing, a passing woman laden with her burden of body and soul. He would interrupt a serious conference with his apostles to fraternize with an intruding child. Nothing ever seemed so important to Jesus as the individual human who chanced to be in his immediate presence. He was master and teacher, but he was more. He was also a friend and neighbor, an understanding comrade. I love that.
Yep, you see the, you know, the obvious point of italicizing there. I mean, he's there to be a revelation of the Father. That's what he's consecrated himself to. Right? And so, sure enough, you see the Father's no respecter of persons, and you see the Father engages you with an absolute individuality attitude.
Right.
He who has seen me has seen the Father. If he wasn't in that mode, right, it would have been different. See, and you know, and remember, it's, you know, it's not like only the seventh bestowal, right, is valid and the others are wrong, right? Because he wasn't doing the Father mode, but doing that initiator mode, doing the Father. This is what, you know, what he, how he needs to present that. You know, it's an every human being in the mode of individual human.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? There's the cosmic totality attitude that's no respecter of persons, but that's a reciprocal mode. But when you're talking about the Father, right, that no respecter of persons is in the absolute individuality attitude. And so it's just about your inner life, the only place where there are no other individuals.
Yeah.
Your outer life, there's lots of other individuals.
So Jesus' public teaching mainly consisted in parables and short discourses. He invariably taught his apostles by question and answers. He would always pause to answer sincere questions during his later public discourses.
Yeah, just you know, that upholding that mode of getting people to awaken their minds and ask questions, and then now that a question's been asked, the question can be answered. But you can't answer questions that aren't being asked.
Yeah.
That basic mode of, you know, it doesn't do you any good to just, you know, talk at a wall. Before you broadcast, you need to turn on the receivers.
Sure.
How do you do that?
Active and questioning selves, huh?
Mm-hmm. Right. Because you want it to be a human experience, so it has to be an active and questioning self. Yes, exactly, Brad.
Okay, that was interesting. The apostles were at first shocked by, but early became accustomed to, Jesus' treatment of women. He made it very clear to them that women were to be accorded equal rights with men in the kingdom.
And just, you know, we all know about that, but just use that, those final three words, to remind you of why, you know, why this is. You know, what's the predicate? Right? In the kingdom,
in
there
the
aren't
kingdom,
males
right.
and females, right?
Right.
There is no males and females in the inner life. That, males and females are in the outer life. Right? And so just, you know, not only, you know, that consideration when you're thinking about both. But, you know, think about yourself, whether you're a male or a female listening to me. You know, to find your inner life is to find something that's transcendent of whether you're, you know, a male or a female. If you still are kind of conscious of your maleness or your femaleness, that's not your inner life.
Wow.
That's your feelings about your outer life. Personalized self of spiritualized mind. Personality is neither male nor female. Right? You're trying to transcend that. That's your inner life. Andrea, you're a little bit, a little bit muddled. Your voice. Maybe Kermit should take it forward.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you.
Okay, I'll be happy to do that. Section 9, 5 months of testing. This somewhat monotonous period of alternate fishing and personal work proved to be a grueling experience for the 12 apostles, but they endured the test. With all of their grumblings, doubts, and transient dissatisfactions, they remained true to their vows of devotion and loyalty to the Master. It was their personal association with Jesus during these months of testing that so endeared him to them that they all, St. Judas Iscariot, these remained loyal and true to him even in the dark hours of the trial and crucifixion. Real men simply could not actually desert a revered teacher who had lived so close to them and had been so devoted to them as had Jesus. Through the dark hours of the Master's death, in the hearts of these apostles, all reason, judgment, and logic were set aside in deference to just one extraordinary human emotion, the supreme sentiment of friendship loyalty. These 5 months of work with Jesus led these apostles, each one of them, to regard him as the best friend he had in all the world, and it was this human sentiment, and not his superb teachings or marvelous doings, that held them together until after the resurrection and the renewal of the proclamation of the gospel of the kingdom.
Yeah. So, well, one little thing. Notice that this was a monotonous period, a grueling experience. It's like, wait a minute, I thought they said they had wonderful times.
Yeah, exactly.
Which one is it? Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
no,
right.
There was occasional little Mount of Transfiguration moments that were wonderful times. But, you know, the general drone tone was grueling. So that's kind of interesting. But notice that, again, the key is the inner life in the hearts of these apostles. Okay, and we're talking about an extreme challenge, so that, you know, even reason, judgment, and logic, right, the more experiential elements of your inner life, you know, weren't up to it. It had to boil down to the existential element of love. Jesus got that established enough. You know, you see, those are, you know, the word friend, right? When you're talking about friendship loyalty, in other words, inner life love-ship loyalty, right? I mean, the loyalty and the emotion, right? You know, that's in the lower domain and in the outer life, but nonetheless, that inner life predicate of love, right? To have that existential rock, right? So that even, you know, when even reason, judgment, and logic are not up to the, you know, the task, they're too shaky, right? Stand upon that which is unshakable, because it has nothing to do with time, the existential.
Right.
Their friendship existed, right? So it just existed.
Yeah. I like that there is such a thing as true sentiment. There is a supreme sentiment. Lately for me, I've noticed I tend to think of the word sentiment as intrinsically negative. Because of its popular usage.
Yeah. And again, it is negative when it's merely bottom up. But all these things can be, you know, can be made new. Right? When those outer life elements are founded on the inner life, then they're true. They can even be supreme.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Not only...
No, go ahead.
Are we ready? Okay. Not only were these months of quiet work a great test to the apostles, a test which they survived, but this season of public inactivity was a great trial to Jesus' family. By the time Jesus was prepared to launch forth on his public work, his entire family, except Ruth, had practically deserted him. On only a few occasions did they attempt to make subsequent contact with him, and then it was to persuade him to return home with them, for they came near to believing that he was beside himself. They simply could not fathom his philosophy nor grasp his teaching. It was all too much for those of his own flesh and blood.
So they're just wandering around Galilee and stuff, carrying the straitjacket, trying to track him down. Notice, you know, how these two paragraphs here are juxtaposed. They want you to think about the contrast. So as we just emphasized, it was the spiritual gravity of the inner life, right, that held them, right, the apostles. But what do they emphasize at the end of this one? Of his own flesh and blood. Too much material gravity.
Too much.
Right? That's the issue with, right, you know, his family. Right? There's so much material gravity, they can't get to their inner life. They can't get to the spiritual life, except Ruth. You know, notice there's, in each case, there's, you know, except Judas, and then here it's except Ruth. There's always an exception, but they're trying to point the rule. One is being ruled by spiritual gravity, the other is being ruled by material gravity, and you get the opposite. It's almost like they're reciprocal gravities.
What do you know?
Funny that.
Right. Yeah. So just, you know, how in anything that's flesh and blood like, see, you know, notice you're going to have this difficulty. It's going to be very difficult for you to be unnatural in the face of that much material gravity. And you have to challenge yourself all the more. Right? You have a natural temperament to, you know, and a natural affinity to the thoughts of, you know, of people who are naturally like you. You've got to overcome that.
Yeah.
Right? As opposed to, oh, well, I mean, obviously I'm the definition of good, and that, so that affinity is good, so they're good, and it's, you know, this is all good. It's, you know, and anyone that's different is bad. You have to challenge that tendency.
The apostles carried on their personal work in Capernaum, Bethsaida Julius, Chorazin, Gerizim, Hippos, Magdala, Cana, Bethlehem of Galilee, Jotapata, Ramah, Safed, Geshala, Gadara, and Abila. Besides these towns, they labored in many villages as well in the countryside. By the end of this period, the 12 had worked out fairly satisfactory plans for the care of their respective families. Most of the apostles were married. Some had several children. But they had made such arrangements for the support of their home folks that with some little assistance from the apostolic funds, they could devote their entire energies to the master's work without having to worry about the financial welfare of the families.
Again, all of the, as Brad was saying, logistics and all the material pragmatism, as we'll, you know, as we'll point out, you know, that whole big list of, you know, of towns and then the unnamed villages, right, as we'll see, all of that is, you know, they didn't just stumble around and happen upon those towns. It's all logistically planned. We're going to go here, and then we're going to go there. Yeah, and they're you know, they're ranging over that whole kind of northern region there of Palestine.
Yeah.
you know, east and west, and all of the logistics of that. You know, they didn't just, well, we, you know, we got to this town, and man, we just got, there were so many fascinating things. I mean, we just got stuck, and, you know, we were planning on going to other towns, but we didn't quite get to it. That didn't happen, right? They didn't get so caught up in their, you know, in their spiritual idealism, as it were, right? that they ended up being as not as effective as they could have been.
And, you know, this paragraph makes me think, I find myself wondering, all this planning for the welfare of their families so it wouldn't disrupt their activities in the public ministry, was this advice and these, you know, this planning, these activities, was it instigated and led by Jesus, or was it such a practical matter that it might have been someone like Andrew or one of the other, you know, leaders in the group of, you know, who said, we all really need to make sure we take care of our families so that when Jesus said our hour has come, it's here. I'm not sure I know the answer, but it makes me wonder.
We got that little hint. It kind of seemed like maybe Jesus, you know, reminded of them up front, you know, of that.
Right.
The material pragmatism, kind of, you know, breaking their, you know, their fixation on him. Oh, yeah, I hadn't even thought about that, right? You know, and once you reminded them, you know, then they sort of took it up, you know, Andrew in the lead, and, you know, took care of all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Great precision.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
But, you know, it seemed like Jesus needed to kind of, you know, because they were, you know, they would just, like, fixate on him, and, you know, and they wouldn't even eat, right? They all would have starved to death, you know, staring at him with their mouths hanging open.
Right.
Remember, he asked them, how much money you got? Let's pool our resources and see what we got, see how we can carry on here.
I've got a little lint in this pocket. I've got a penny in this pocket. I think we should go fishing.
Section 10, Organization of the 12. The apostles early organized themselves in the following manner. 1. Andrew, the first chosen apostle, was designated chairman and director general of the 12.
Order. We've been talking about.
Yeah.
This is the only part of the Chosen TV series that I think they had no basis for getting it correct, but they kind of put Simon Peter as more of the leader of the apostolic corps, or at least the more charismatic, the one who stands up and says, guys, we got to do something. But, you know, Andrew looks like he was a little bit more of that. And we'll hear lots more about that next week and in the weeks to come.
That's right.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. We should mention that this final section, giving these very thumbnail, you know, comments, you know, is foreshadowing the whole paper that starts our next series, where we go into great detail on each apostle in their chosen order.
Right.
Yeah. You notice they're reminding you that this order is the quote-unquote chosen order, the first chosen. You know, that's why there's a one and a period before the word, you know, the word Andrew. The order is, you know, is not when they were told, follow me. The order is when they were chosen, either by Jesus or one of the other apostles.
2, Peter, James, and John were appointed personal companions of Jesus. They were to attend him day and night, to minister to his physical and sundry needs, and to accompany him on those night vigils of prayer and mysterious communion with the Father in heaven.
You know, we all know, you know, how that plays out so, you know, so constantly in his ministry. You know, and just to note that didn't sort of just, you know, come about. No, it was planned up front. There, you know, everyone gets their duties saying, okay, Peter, James, and John, you're, you know, kind of a fundamental task. You know, I mean, they're all going to do lots of different things, of course. But they're kind of, when all is said and done, this is your task, right? And you have to assume the personal responsibility here above anyone else, you know, any of the other apostles. Right. Yeah, it's just all of that order. You know, you have to kind of, your mind has to kind of chuckle and say, well, what was it like to attend him day and night, to minister to his physical and sundry needs? I mean, yeah, you immediately start thinking of, you know, servants scurrying about, you know, monarchs, you know.
Right, bringing him snacks and stuff.
You're like, can I brush your teeth for you, you know, Lord? And, but you know, it is interesting that, you know, that they're trying to give Jesus as much ability to focus on the important things, you know, so he doesn't have to spend all day washing clothes.
Exactly. 3, Philip was made steward of the group. It was his duty to provide food and to see that visitors and even the multitude of listeners at times had something to eat.
So Philip said, Master, I know it's my job, but I don't think I can feed all these people. I wonder what happens then.
I wonder.
right. And some of the character, some of the nature of the characters of these guys fits into what they were given to do. Philip not being the most imaginative of the 12.
Exactly. That's one of the things we'll want to do. I was going to mention that at some point here. Yeah. That when we're reading through the next paper, we can think back, you know, if they don't bring it up again, oh, yeah, that's why Philip was made steward, or that's why Nathaniel was, you know.
Yeah. 4, Nathaniel watched over the needs of the families of the 12. He received regular reports as to the requirements of each apostle's family, and making requisition on Judas, the treasurer, would send funds each week to those in need.
Yeah, all of these... Yeah, like you were saying, Brad, not all of them are Simon Peter. Right? It's like, you know, there's all of these material pragmatism issues.
It's quite a team. Quite a
that
team.
Obviously don't get writ large in the Gospels.
No, why would they?
Yeah.
5, Matthew was the fiscal agent of the apostolic corps. It was his duty to see that the budget was balanced, the treasury replenished. If the funds for mutual support were not forthcoming, if donations sufficient to maintain the party were not received, Matthew was empowered to order the 12 back to their nets for a season. But this was never necessary after they began their public work. He always had sufficient funds in the treasurer's hands to finance their activities. And we'll find out more about that.
Yeah. If he came up a little bit short, I wonder where he made up the difference. I wonder how he balanced the budget sometimes.
Right. Yeah, not to mention, oh, wait a minute, I thought money was the root of all evil. The apostles would never have all of this fixation on financial matters.
Balanced budgets? What in the...
Yeah.
6. Thomas was the manager of the itinerary. It devolved upon him to arrange lodgings and in a general way select places for teaching and preaching, thereby ensuring a smooth and expeditious travel schedule.
Ah, so all those locations, all those villages, Thomas is charting that all out.
Travel agent.
Yeah.
Yep.
7, James and Judas, the twin sons of Alphaeus, were assigned to the management of the multitudes. It was their task to deputize a sufficient number of assistant ushers to enable them to maintain order among the crowds during the preaching.
So it sounds like maybe some of those ushers we would call bouncers.
Right.
Yeah. Just thought as you mentioned that, you know, I mean, it's kind of a little opportunity to remind yourself of, yeah, we're talking some crowds where there's going to be issues. Who's managing, unruly members in a crowd?
I wonder if they were burly.
Yep. Number 8, James Simon's and Judas aren't doing it directly. They've got someone, right, that... They can point to, drag him out of here.
Number 8, Simon Zelotes was given charge of recreation and play. He managed the Wednesday programs and also sought to provide for a few hours of relaxation and diversion each day.
Oh, so I wonder who might need some constant stimulus to not take himself too seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, who do you think?
some physical activity to blow off some steam and to really get excited about getting other people coordinated with physical activity. You could see why he's
Mister,
doing
that. I want to overthrow the Roman Empire. Let's see, you're going to be in charge of recreation and play.
Tomorrow's volleyball, yeah.
Bingo Wednesdays, yeah.
Number 9, Judas Iscariot was appointed treasurer. He carried the bag. He paid all expenses and kept the books. He made budget estimates for Matthew from week to week and also made weekly reports to Andrew. Judas paid out funds on Andrew's authorization.
So two things. I mean, one, okay, I mean, he's doing budget estimates and, you know, weekly reports and
authorizations.
Yeah.
Triplicate forms.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness gracious. but also notice that, you know, right up front, you know, someone is overseeing, right? It's Matthew or it's Andrew. Right? Judas is not given a point position.
They're accountable.
Yeah. So that's the, it's innate. You know, everyone recognizes where the possible Achilles heel is here. So, he needs to be kind of an automaton, right, with overseers.
An ATM machine. Huh.
Yeah. They organize themselves in this way, yeah.
Even though they do comment, he was never insincere. He was never dishonest with the funds.
Yeah. Right.
Never had an issue with the money.
Yeah, I mean, and Judas, you know, he said, yeah, I can do that job. And he did. He did it, you know, very well. And he recognized his limitations. And, you know, like I said, you know, they organized themselves like this. So, for everyone to see how they can form a system. Each of them can be an element of a system.
In this way, the 12 functioned from their early organization up to the time of the reorganization made necessary by the desertion of Judas, the betrayer. The Master and his disciple apostles went on in this simple manner until Sunday, January 12, AD 27, when he called them together and formally ordained them as ambassadors of the kingdom and preachers of its glad tidings. And soon thereafter, they prepared to start for Jerusalem and Judea on their first public preaching tour.
It almost seems like we
knew what we were doing, making this the final paper in the prelude with that final sentence.
That's a prelude-y sentence,
I'm sorry, Andrea, go ahead. Yeah, I talked on top of you there.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was just saying that they got here another full date, you know, the January 12th, AD 27.
Yeah.
Another very important date there.
Yeah, which they will repeat at the beginning of paper 140 on the ordination of the 12th.
Yeah. These big anchor points. Yeah.
Yeah. The ordination was a big deal. we'll definitely, we'll want to see if we can remember to keep, you know, each of these little vignettes in mind as we go through the apostles in the next paper and touch back, you know, and comment on how well they organized themselves based upon their temperaments.
Yes.
Marvelous study and team building, among many other things. Once you're done getting your inner life in order, you can study team building in the Urantia book too. How about that?
Yep.
Well, all right. That takes us to the end of this week's show and the end of this series, Precursor and Prelude, but we are still in this long arc called Jesus Goes Public. Come back and join us next Tuesday as we get to paper 139, this speaker's third favorite paper in the entire book. I'm not afraid to rank them. Hope you all will enjoy it. We'll see you then. Follow the way.
God bless everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Yes, take care, everyone. Thank you to my co-host, as always. You guys, it's great fun every week here. And tune in next week, everyone, those who are faithful listeners, and we will do as Brad said, start the next series. Love you all. Bye now.